The beacon glass itself lay dull and dormant in the center of the room. You could see for miles to all sides. I stood there for a moment, looking back the way I had come, at the trail that had brought me, at the shadow in the distance that might have been the village, and then to the right, across the last of the marsh. The transition to scrub land and the gnarled bushes punished by the wind off the sea. They, clinging to the soil, stopped it from eroding and helped bulwark the dunes and the sea oats that came next. It was a gentle slope from there to the glittering beach, the surf, and the waves. A second look, and from the direction of base camp amid the swamp and far distant pines, I could see strands of black smoke, which could have meant anything, but I also could see, from the location of the tower, a kind of brightness of its own, a sort of refracted phosphorescence that did not bear thinking about. That I could see it, that I had an affinity to it, agitated me. I was certain that no one else left here, not the surveyor, not the psychologist, could see that stirring of the inexplicable. I turned my attention to the chairs, the table, searching for whatever might give me insight into anything. After about 5 minutes, I thought to pull back the rug. A square trap door, measuring about 4 feet per side, lay hidden there. The latch was set into the wood of the floor. I pushed the table out of the way with a terrible rending sound that made me grit my teeth. Then, swiftly, in case someone waited down there, I threw open the trapdoor, shouting out something inane like, "I've got a gun!" aiming my weapon with one hand and my flashlight with the other. I had the distant sense of the weight of my gun dropping to the floor, my flashlight shaking in my hand, though somehow I held on to it. I could not believe what I was staring down at, and I felt lost. The trapdoor opened into a space about 15 feet deep and 30 feet wide. The psychologist had clearly been there, for her knapsack, several weapons, bottles of water, and a large flashlight lay off to the left side, but of the psychologist herself there was no sign. No, what had me gasping for breath, what felt like a punch in the stomach as I dropped to my knees, was the huge mound that dominated the space, a kind of insane midden. I was looking at a pile of papers with hundreds of journals on top of it, just like the ones we had been issued to record our observations of Area X, each with a job title written on the front, each, as it turned out, filled with writing, many, many more than could possibly have been filed by only 12 expeditions. Can you really imagine what it was like in those first moments, peering down into that dark space and seeing that? Perhaps you can. Perhaps you're staring at it now. My third and best field assignment out of college required that I travel to a remote location on the western coast, to a curled hook of land at the farthest extremity from civilization, in an area that teetered between temperate and Arctic climates. Here the earth had disgorged huge rock formations, and an old-growth rainforest had sprouted up around them. This world was always moist, the annual rainfall more than 70 inches a year, and not seeing droplets of water on leaves was an extraordinary event. The air was so amazingly clean and the vegetation so dense, so richly green, that every spiral of fern seemed designed to make me feel at peace with the world. Bears and panthers and elk lived in those forests, along with a multitude of bird species. The fish in the streams were mercury-free and enormous. I lived in a village of about 300 souls near the coast. I had rented a cottage next to a house at the top of a hill that had belonged to 5 generations of fisher folk. A husband and wife, childless, owned the property, and they had the kind of severely laconic quality common to the area. I made no friends there, and I wasn't sure that even long-standing neighbors were friends either. Only in the local pub that everyone frequented, after a few pints, would you see signs of friendliness and camaraderie. But violence lived in the pub, too, and I kept away most of the time. I was 4 years away from meeting my future husband, and at the time I wasn't looking for much of anything from anyone. I had plenty to keep me busy. Every day I drove the hellish winding road, rutted and treacherous even when dry, that led me to the place they called simply Rock Bay. There, sheets of magma that lay beyond the rough beaches had been worn smooth over millions of years and become pitted with tidal pools. At low tide in the morning, I would photograph those tidal pools, take measurements, and catalog the life found within them, sometimes staying through part of high tide, wading in my rubber boots, the spray from the waves that smashed over the lip of the ledge drenching me. A species of mussels found nowhere else lived in those tidal pools, in a symbiotic relationship with a fish called a gartner, after its discoverer. Several species of marine snails and sea anemones lurked there, too, and a tough little squid I nicknamed St. Pugnacious, eschewing its scientific name because the danger music of its white flashing luminescence made its mantle look like a pope's hat. I could easily lose hours there, observing the hidden life of tidal pools, and sometimes I marveled at the fact that I had been given such a gift, not just to lose myself in the present moment so utterly, but also to have such solitude, which was all I had ever craved during my studies, my practice to reach this point. Even then, though, during the drives back, I was grieving the anticipated end of this happiness, because I knew it had to end eventually. The research grant was only for 2 years, and who really would care about mussels longer than that? And it's true, my research methods could be eccentric. These were the kinds of thoughts I'd have as the expiration date came nearer and the prospects looked dimmer and dimmer for renewal. Against my better judgment, I began to spend more and more time in the pub. I'd wake in the morning, my head fuzzy, sometimes with someone I knew, but who was a stranger just leaving, and realize I was one day closer to the end of it all. Running through it, too, was a sense of relief, not as strong as the sadness, but the thought, counter to everything else I felt, that this way I would not become that person the locals saw on the rocks and still thought of as an outsider. "Oh, that's just the old biologist. She's been here for ages, going crazy studying those mussels. She talks to herself, mutters to herself at the bar. If you say a kind word..." When I saw those hundreds of journals, I felt, for a long moment, that I had become that old biologist after all. That's how the madness of the world tries to colonize you, from the outside in, forcing you to live in its reality. Reality encroaches in other ways, too. At some point during our relationship, my husband began to call me the ghost bird, which was his way of teasing me for not being present enough in his life. It would be said with a kind of creasing at the corner of his lips that almost formed a thin smile, but in his eyes I could see the reproach. If we went to bars with his friends, one of his favorite things to do, I would volunteer only what a prisoner might during an interrogation. They weren't my friends, not really, but also I wasn't in the habit of engaging in small talk, nor in broad talk, as I like to call it. I didn't care about politics except in how politics impinged upon the environment. I wasn't religious. All of my hobbies were bound up in my work. I lived for the work, and I thrilled with the power of that focus. But it was also deeply personal. I didn't like to talk about my research. I didn't wear makeup or care about new shoes or the latest music. I'm sure my husband's friends found me taciturn or worse. Perhaps they even found me unsophisticated or strangely uneducated, as I heard one of them say, although I don't know if he was referring to me. I enjoyed the bars, but not for the same reasons as my husband. I loved the late-night slow burn of being out, my mind turning over some problem, some piece of data, while able to appear sociable but still existing apart. He worried too much about me, though, and my need for solitude ate into his enjoyment of talking to friends, who were mostly from the hospital. I would see him trail off in mid-sentence, gazing at me for some sign of my own contentment, as, off to the side, I drank my whiskey neat. "Ghost bird," he would say later, "did you have fun?" I'd nod and smile. But fun for me was sneaking off to peer into a tidal pool, to grasp the intricacies of the creatures that lived there. Sustenance for me was tied to ecosystem and habitat. Orgasm, the sudden realization of the interconnectivity of living things. Observation had always meant more to me than interaction. He knew all of this, I think, but I never could express myself that well to him, although I did try, and he did listen. And yet, I was nothing but expression in other ways. My sole gift or talent, I believe now, was that places could impress themselves upon me, and I could become a part of them with ease. Even a bar was a type of ecosystem, if a crude one. And to someone entering, someone without my husband's agenda, that person could have seen me sitting there and had no trouble imagining that I was happy in my little bubble of silence. Would have had no trouble believing I fit in. Yet even as my husband wanted me to be assimilated in a sense, the irony was that he wanted to stand out. Seeing that huge pile of journals, this was another thing I thought of, that he had been wrong for the 11th expedition because of this quality, that here were the indiscriminate accounts of so many souls, and that his account couldn't possibly stand out, that in the end he'd been reduced to a state that approximated my own. Those journals, flimsy gravestones, confronted me with my husband's death all over again. I dreaded finding his, dreaded knowing his true account, not the featureless generic mutterings he had given to our superiors upon his return. "Ghost bird, do you love me?" he whispered once in the dark before he left for his expedition training, even though he was the ghost. "Ghost bird, do you need me?" I loved him, but I didn't need him. And I thought that was the way it was supposed to be. A ghost bird might be a hawk in one place, a crow in another, depending on the context. The sparrow that shot up into the blue sky one morning might transform mid-flight into an osprey the next. This was the way of things here. There were no reasons so mighty that they could override the desire to be in accord with the tides and the passage of seasons and the rhythms underlying everything around me. The journals and other materials formed a moldering pile about 12 feet high and 16 feet wide that in places near the bottom had clearly turned to compost, the paper rotting away. Beetles and silverfish tended to those archives, and tiny black cockroaches with always moving antennae. Toward the base and spilling out at the edges, I saw the remains of photographs and dozens of ruined cassette tapes mixed in with the mulch of pages. There, too, I saw evidence of rats. I would have to lower myself down into the midden by means of the ladder nailed to the lip of the trapdoor and trudge through a collapsing garbage hill of disintegrating pulp to uncover anything at all. The scene obliquely embodied the scrap of writing I'd encountered on the tower wall. The seeds of the dead to share with the worms that gather in the darkness and surround the world with the power of their lives. I overturned the table and laid it across the narrow entrance to the stairwell. I had no idea where the psychologist had gotten to, but I didn't want her or anyone else surprising me. If someone tried to move the table from below, I would hear it and have time to climb up to greet them with my gun. I also had a sensation I can, in hindsight, attribute to the brightness growing within me, of a presence pressing up from below, impinging on the edges of my senses, a prick.